characters that are not as well known, maybe not look at some of the major characters of the New Testament. And yet when you think about Luke initially, you may say, well, he's one of the major characters of the New Testament. And I think we probably say that because he's got a book named after him, right? And so that makes him a major character of the New Testament. But if you had to start to think, as you've read through the New Testament, how many times have you read the name Luke in your reading of the New Testament? I'm not saying how many times you've read his book. By the way, his name's never mentioned in the book of Luke. But how many times have you come across his name? I mean, if you're going to think of someone who's a major character, how many times do you read the name Peter? Or how many times do you read the name John? Or how many times do you read the name Paul? You read those a lot. How many times do you read the name Luke when you look at your Bibles? We're going to look at this man in the time that we've got this morning and briefly just do a little introduction here about some of the basic things of his life. But I want us to look at four things in his life after we get beyond this point that I think are interesting for us to see, just to learn about this guy that really I don't think we know too much about. First of all, he was a Greek. And I don't know what that means to you, but you pick up your New Testaments and how many books, I don't know if it's on this slide or not, how many books were written by Jews of the New Testament? You got 27 books in the New Testament. How many of them were written by Jews? Pretty close, 25. 26 would be right, but Luke wrote two of the books. And so he's the only author that's not a Jew. He's the only Gentile author of the New Testament. Here's this Greek. He's writing, and we're going to talk a little bit more about this when we get to him being a historian in a minute, but here's a Greek writing to a Greek named Theophilus, and he's presenting Jesus from a Grecian point of view. And all that means is when he's writing to Theophilus, he's going to write about Jesus. Not that he's changing the facts, not that he's making up facts, but he's going to present him in a way that would be understandable, that would be appealing to those who are from that Grecian background. Here he is writing the third and the fifth books of the New Testament, yet we don't actually read about him until you get to Acts chapter 16. And we don't actually read his name until you get to Colossians chapter 4. So here's a character that we should know a lot about. I mean, here's a man who has a book not only named after him, but has written two books, and yet his own name's not even mentioned until you get to Colossians chapter 4. But when you look at the writers of the New Testament, you remember in Acts chapter 4? Is it Acts 4? Where Peter and John are before the Sanhedrin? What was the Sanhedrin's, what was their evaluation of Peter and John? Was their evaluation of Peter and John that they were well-educated? No. Were they eloquent men? No. Their evaluation of Peter and John was what? Ignorant and unlearned men. You couldn't say that about Luke, though. Why did they say that about Peter and John? Were they ignorant and unlearned? I mean, did these guys not know anything? What's the deal? They're fishermen. So is that a stereotype for fishermen? Apparently in that day it was. I don't know if I want to bring it to this day and offend any fishermen today. But here were these guys, and to some people's minds in that day, oh, they're just fishermen. They don't know anything. These guys are uneducated. You come to Luke, here's a man who is educated. Here's a man who is versed in the Greek language. Here is a man that is very knowledgeable in all of these things that are down in the bottom of the screen here. Here's a man that is refined and cultured for his day. And so, again, he's different in that respect. Why do you think? Do you think God intentionally chose different men like this? I mean, do you think he intentionally chose Luke to write the Gospel of Luke rather than why don't we have the Gospel of James or the Gospel of Andrew? Luke's not even an apostle. Why choose this man to write the Gospel of Luke in the book of Acts? Okay. so that you can have a wider appeal of Jesus. Here's four things I want us to talk about. First of all, was Luke, obviously, and I've already got on the screen, so I won't ask the question. Here's Luke, he's the physician. And that's what Paul calls him in Colossians chapter 4. First time we read his name, he's called Luke, the beloved physician. So that sets him apart. Sets him apart from these fishermen, sets him apart from some of these others that are followers of Jesus. But when you think about Luke being a physician, we sometimes think that these people who lived in the first century were primitive. You know, we think, oh boy, they lived 2,000 years ago, so they really didn't have much. They really didn't know much. They really couldn't do much. You know, sometimes we have that mentality sometimes we think about that when we talk about their preservation of alcohol or preservation of grape juice specifically. We think back, well, they didn't have refrigerators, didn't have any way to cool it, so they couldn't preserve it. And so surely after they squeezed it from the grape, almost immediately it became fermented because they had no way to preserve it. We want to impose some kind of primitive, ignorant, they didn't know anything, hadn't learned anything, and such could not be further from the truth than their preservation of grape juice. Did they have refrigerators? No. But did they find ways to preserve it to the point that it would last for years unfermented? Yes. So they're not primitive people. And they weren't primitive when it came to medicine either. You know, we might look at their methods as kind of crude, right? You know, they didn't have all of the advances in technology that we have. But the school of medicine that was primarily in Alexandria, Egypt, that's where... You know, out of Egypt came most of their medical knowledge and most of their physicians. And it's possible that Luke was from Antioch and he studied in the medical school that was in Antioch. But they had methods, and you've already had time to look and see that, you know, they were performing surgeries like boring holes into the skull to relieve that fluid pressure that may have come from a concussion or may have come from some kind of tumor or something. I don't know about you, but I don't even want to have a hole drilled in my head today, right? I mean, of all the surgery possibilities, let's think. Let somebody take a drill and put a hole in my skull, you know? And with all of our advances today, I still don't want that. They were doing it 2,000 years ago. Now, how did they figure that out? You know, you go back and think, you know, who was the first person who figured out, oh, you're having a headache? Let me go get the drill and put a hole in your head. You want to tell me what electric, you know, what electric socket they plugged that drill into? You know, let's think here. But it wasn't as primitive as we would make it out to be. So here's Luke the physician. Here's a man who was very educated. The doctors back then had a wide range of knowledge. They had general knowledge about even, you know, herbal medicines and how to treat things. But here was Luke who's educated. And not just educated in the field of medicine, but someone who had a wide range of knowledge about things. Because, you know, if you're a doctor back then, you're gonna get all sorts of things. You know, doctors today get all sorts of things brought to them. What about this? What about that? And so they did back then. So here's an educated man serving God, and it comes through in his writings. And this is just some from the book of Luke. I don't have a chapter there. Peter's mother-in-law's chapter 4 and verse 38. But here's just a few examples where you see some of Luke's medical terminology just coming through his writings. And we wouldn't notice it. Some of these just come from the Greek words that are used, so some of these wouldn't be quite apparent. It may not be a big deal to us that Luke is the one who tells us that Peter's mother-in-law had a high fever. But, they categorized fevers in that day, and to this doctor, it was not just a fever she had, it was a high fever. He uses different terms to talk about those who had leprosy. And this man in chapter 5 who was full of leprosy was probably further along or at least had the disease even worse than those 10 lepers because they're described differently just in the terminology. So here's a doctor. And it's almost like he's diagnosing the people in the terms that he's using. And Jesus is talking in Luke 21:34 about the fact that some of their hearts had been weighed down with their drunkenness and with their carousing. Well, the word weighed down is a medical term. Jesus is basically saying, you all are nauseous by the fact that you've been partying and drinking so much, you're making yourself sick. We think about their hearts being weighed down. Luke's using a medical term. We don't see it in the English, but Luke used a different term to talk about those who were paralyzed than Matthew and Mark did. He used the actual medical term to talk about it. When that demon-possessed man from the Gadarenes, Luke's the one who tells us, a little bit about his condition a little bit more. The woman in Luke 8:44 who had the flow of blood, the issue of the flow of blood, Luke's the one who uses that medical term that when her blood flow stopped, he uses this term staunch, which was a medical term. When in Luke chapter 9 and verse 38, when someone comes to Jesus, this man comes to Jesus and says, look on my son. It wasn't just, use your eyes, but it was the medical term for like doing a checkup. It wasn't just come and see him. It was the medical term that was used for an examination that a doctor would do. And there's several others on here, and we can't look at all of them. Obviously, Luke 22:44, where Jesus began to sweat, as it were, great drops of blood. It's not just a figurative language. It's a literal medical condition that was happening with Jesus, and that could happen then, can still happen today, called hematidrosis. And it's the physician who's telling us about this. And then when Peter cuts off Malchus's ear, Luke doesn't tell us his name. It's John who tells us that it's Malchus. So maybe that indicates to us that doctors really don't care what your name is. Maybe they're just more concerned about your condition. That's not what it means. But anyway, he's the one who tells us what ear it was. It was the right ear. So, a doctor, usually you want to know that, right? Which ear has been cut off? Can you believe that some doctors amputate the wrong leg? So Luke says, this was the ear that was amputated. This was the ear that was cut off. And he's the one who tells us that Jesus picked up the ear, touched the man, and healed the man. And it's over and over. These are a few examples. You go to the book of Acts, same thing. Same thing in the book of Acts. You see his medical background coming through. And when we'll look at it in a minute, him being a companion of Paul, but if you're Paul, 2 Corinthians chapter 11, where it talks about Paul's being beaten with rods, being stoned, being imprisoned, wouldn't you like to have a doctor traveling with you when all of this is happening? I mean, what better companion to have than a physician? And no doubt Luke was the one who helped not only to preserve Paul's life in these cases, but to extend his life. Think if a physician hadn't been with Paul when all of these things are happening to him. Here's a doctor traveling with him, and here's a doctor who even in that day was described physicians as one of the most lucrative or the most lucrative business of the day. And yet Luke left Antioch. He left Troas when Paul was there in Acts 16. And instead of holding down some kind of medical practice where he could earn a lot of money, he goes and travels with an apostle. Here was a lucrative business that he was in, and yet Luke was willing to say, I'm not concerned about the money. I'm not concerned about using my abilities to earn money. I'd rather go use my abilities to serve God. And I think that's something that we need to recognize about our own lives. We all have jobs. We all have abilities. And sometimes we look at those abilities and those talents that we have and say, what can I do for me? What can I gain for myself based upon what I'm able to do? And here was Luke, who in all reality had every right to stay in a city and have his own practice and be able to earn money, and yet he had a greater purpose in life and was willing to use that. Scott?
Occupation versus vocation. It seems to me in times past I've seen it used the opposite way. Our occupation is with Christ and our vocation is what we do for work. Could you explain that?
Well, that's why I've got the word occupation in quotes, because that's the way we look at it. We look at it as our occupation. We look at it as this is my career, and so this is my life's ambition. And yet, in reality, I think the word vocation could be used in both respects. But that's the only reason your comment, well, I put occupation in quotes, is to say that's the way we look at it, and yet our occupation, our career, our life goal is serving God, is it not? I mean, it should be. We think 40 hours a week, 5 days a week, however many days we work, we earn this amount, and that's our life. And yet, and Scott, I think you're right that they are flipped in respect that our goal, our occupation in life is serving God. And yeah, over here I've got a job that helps me to have food on the table and support my family. Which does God require us to do that?
Yes.
Does God require us to work?
Yes.
Yes. Does God require us to supply for our families? Yes. So I am fulfilling my obligations to God by having this job, but it's not the reverse. I'm not having this job, and then if I have time, I'll fulfill my obligations to God as when I have time. So good comment, good question, Scott. Luke is also not only just a physician, but you take his, hopefully what you have in a physician is somebody who's detail-oriented. Somebody who amputates the wrong leg apparently is not very detail-oriented, I don't guess. But, in a physician, you want somebody who's detail-oriented, don't you? Somebody who's going to find the problem and is going to fix the problem. And so here's this detail-oriented guy that is chosen to be the historian of the New Testament. You go back into the Old Testament. How many books of history, as we categorize them, how many books of history do we have in the Old Testament? How many? I got some disparaging comments here. How many books of history as we divide it up? See, here's the deal. That's why I said as we divide it up. Because when you look at Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, we call those what? The books of the law. Are you kidding me? Is there no history in there? We don't categorize. Okay, so that's why that's a tricky question. Well, see, that's how we categorize as having 12 books of history, right? From Joshua through what? Esther? Are our books of history. But if those are our only historical books, guess what? You've left out like the first 2,500 years of history if we don't categorize Genesis, Exodus, and Deuteronomy, all of those in there, as history.
You asked how we categorize.
You're right. I asked how we categorize them, 12 books, right? Now, if you lump five in there for the first 2,500 years, here we've got 17 books. And of course, we could go on and on about the prophets and say they fit in there too. But you've got somewhere 12 to 17 books of history. How many books of history do you have in the New Testament as we categorize them? One. Book of Acts, right? All right, now, really all of the New Testament is history, isn't it? I mean, it tells us about the life of Jesus, the growth of the church, and the advancement of the church, so all of it is. But here's Luke, and Luke writes the only book of history that we have. Did God choose the right guy to do it, or should he have gotten Peter or John, one of these ignorant and unlearned men, to do it? He chose somebody who's detail-oriented. And he chooses somebody whose name is only mentioned three times in the New Testament. He's not a major character as we would look at it, or as we might categorize it. And yet God chooses this man to write more of the New Testament than anybody else. We often think about Paul writing more of the New Testament than anybody else because he wrote 13 books. If you write 13 books, you get more credit for writing two books, right? But if you leave out the book of Hebrews, because we don't know who wrote the book of Hebrews, just by number of words, number of pages, Luke wrote more than Paul. If you give Hebrews to Paul, which some people do, then Paul gets a little bit more. But we don't think about Luke actually writing that much of the New Testament. And yet he writes most of it. He gives us a history of the life of Jesus. He gives us a history of the growth of the New Testament. Here's this Gentile writing to Gentile readers, and we mentioned this at the beginning, how he takes Jesus and presents Jesus to the Gentile mind. You think about Matthew. How did Matthew write about Jesus? How did he present Jesus? Matthew writes 28 chapters about Jesus. How does he present him? From a Jewish perspective. He presents Jesus as the Messiah. Did that mean something to a Jew? If you were to present Jesus as the Messiah to a Gentile, is that going to mean anything to him? But like, that's a funny word, isn't it? Messiah? Hadn't heard that one before. So he doesn't present him as the Messiah as Matthew would. Matthew's writing to a Jewish audience, and so it's obvious that's the way he needs to present him. But Luke's writing to a Gentile, to a Greek audience, and Jesus needs to be presented in such a way that the Greeks would understand. And so he is written as this perfect Son of Man. Think about the Greeks and how much they wanted and how much they searched for that perfect, ideal person. Luke comes along. He says, that's who Jesus is. He's the perfect, ideal Son of Man. Now, he frequently calls Jesus the Son of Man. Even Jesus, Luke chapter 19 and verse 10, even when he's quoting Jesus, what does Jesus say in Luke 19, 10? Does he say the Son of God has come to seek and to save the lost? Is that what Luke 19, 10 says? The Son of Man has come to seek and to save that which was lost. So he presents him as a human, from the human perspective, but more than that, as the perfect one. When he presents the genealogy of Jesus, he doesn't take Jesus back to Abraham. Why not? Gentiles don't care about that. Whoop-de-doo. He goes back to the genealogy of Jesus all the way back to Adam, and then obviously explains a lot of these Jewish things that some of these Gentiles wouldn't understand. But when he begins Luke chapter 1, look there just briefly in Luke chapter 1. We'll look at those first couple verses. It's obvious that Luke's detail-oriented, we use other words today for people who are detail-oriented, don't we? Some of them I don't think are very nice. I take offense to some of them. But here's this man who is detail-oriented, and he says in Luke chapter 1, and as much as many, think about that word. We think Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Luke says, and as much as many have taken in hand to set in order a narrative of the things, of those things which have been fulfilled among us, just as those who from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word delivered them to us, it seemed good to me. Notice what he says in verse 2. Those who were from the beginning eyewitnesses, those who were from the beginning ministers of the word, they delivered these things to us. What does that say about Luke? Was Luke just an eyewitness that was there, or had he had these things delivered to him? He says, it seemed good to me also, having had perfect understanding of all things from the very first, to write to you an orderly account, most excellent Theophilus, that you may know the certainty of those things in which you were instructed. What does that word orderly mean? Sometimes we think, it means chronologically, and that's not what it means. Matthew and Mark are more chronological than Luke is. What does it mean if you write something in an orderly account? Logical. It's organized. So there's some cases where Matthew and Mark might be chronological, where Luke takes a thought, takes an idea, takes something that's happening, and he rides it on out to its end, and then he'll come back and pick up something else that may have happened earlier in time, but it's the logical way, it's the orderly, organized way to say, here's what we need to know about this. And so here's this detail-oriented man who's going to write about the life of Jesus. He's going to write it to Gentiles, to Greeks who like things in a structured, ordered manner. And he's a historian who's reliable. There have been a lot of people who have studied the book of Luke and the book of Acts. And they have tried, especially the book of Acts, They have tried to find mistakes in the book of Acts. They've tried to find mistakes about the people that are mentioned. Is it on this slide? There's about 110 people who are mentioned in the book of Acts. Not to mention, it's like, what is it, at least 50 or 60, I can't remember the exact number, of just cities that are mentioned in the book of Acts. And you put all of these things together, and not only the names and the cities, but the directions in which he says they went up or they went down or they went over. You put all of the details in the book of Acts together, and there have been people who have thought, you know, if we can discredit the Bible, all we've got to do is come to the book of Acts and find one of these names to be wrong, one of these cities to be wrong, one of these compass directions to be wrong, whatever. And if we can find a mistake, we can prove that this book is no good. So there have been people who have gone out on an adventure to do that. In fact, this man who you've already seen, this man, William Ramsey, he spent 34 years, as this parenthetical statement says, spent 34 years proving the historical reliability of Luke, except that was not the purpose for which he set out. William Ramsey went over to try to prove Luke to be an unreliable writer. William Ramsey was one of these skeptics who wanted to come to the Bible, find mistakes so that he could hold it up, say, there's all sorts of holes here, don't believe it. William Ramsey goes over, and he dedicates his life. He first of all dedicated his life to destroying the Bible, and then he got over there and said, no mistakes. Every person that has been mentioned, they're right where they ought to be. And some of these things on here, how Luke wrote about senatorial provinces, you know, which may not mean a whole lot to us, but he knew that they were ruled by proconsuls, whereas Thessalonica was ruled by Polytarchs, whereas Ephesus had Asiarchs in charge. Now, some of those words we don't have because those are the Greek words, and so we just have rulers, or we have, council in some of those places in English. But how did Luke know that those were three different governmental areas ruled by three different governmental bodies? He got it right every time. And so here's this historian writing for us a book that has been challenged, that people have tried to find mistakes and holes in, and yet every time they have come to it, the Bible's held up. And every time they've come to Luke, this detail-oriented guy, he's gotten it right every time. And so here's Luke, who had also a great command of the Greek language. He was obviously educated, and so he had a great ability not only to write, but he had a great vocabulary. In the Greek language, you'll find almost 800 words in the book of Luke and Acts, books of Luke and Acts that aren't anywhere else in the New Testament. And I think you also see a picture of inspiration when you look at Luke, the inspiration of God. He says in Luke 1 that he was not an eyewitness. These things had been delivered to him. You read the 28 chapters of the book of Acts, how many of those things did Luke witness himself? He witnessed some of those things in the life of Paul. But how many of those things did he actually see? You know, how did Luke know what to write? How did he know how to write an orderly account? He didn't know how. Unless it was God who gave him everything that he needed to know to write. Couple more things I want us to see. Not only is he just a historian from this standpoint where he just presents facts. You can pick up a history book and most history books you read, you're not going to get any warm fuzzies from them, are you? I mean, it's just going to be facts. This happened on this day in this city, and, you know, you go on. And if it's just history, you want it reliable, but it doesn't really have to impress you with anything on the emotional side. But yet, when you read the book of Luke and the book of Acts, it's not just cold history. You find a writer who's a very compassionate, tender-hearted humanitarian, and it comes across in his writings. For instance, I think we've talked about this in some class before. Luke gives great attention to people who in that day and time didn't give a lot of attention. He gives a lot of attention to women, and here's, I think, at least 90%, if not all of the women that Luke mentions. And some of these aren't mentioned by anybody else. And he mentions a lot of these by name. And then there's others like in Luke 15 with the woman that looking for the lost coin. In Luke chapter 18, that parable of the persistent widow. And throughout the book of Luke, and if you compare them, if you read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, it's interesting to see that Luke gives more attention to the women in certain cases than do some others. He's the one who talks about the woman who spoke out from the crowd. He's the one who talks about this woman who's bent over. And obviously, some of these women are mentioned in the other gospel accounts, but he seems to give more attention to the women. Maybe he would just, was a nice, friendly guy, and he was looking for a wife or something. I don't know. He gives a lot of attention to the children. He shows a lot of concern for the poor. He has parables, the parable of the great feast in Luke chapter 14, the attention that's given to the poor and others in that. In Luke chapter 16, we have this story about a rich man and a beggar in Luke 16. Who gets the better side of that story in Luke 16, the rich man or the beggar? Why let the beggar win, Here's the rich man. Here's this man who fared sumptuously every day. Let's have a story about him. The story wasn't about him, although it was. Here's a story about this beggar named Lazarus. And it's interesting that Jesus even chose to give him a name. And then there are those social outcasts that Luke mentions more than anybody else. What gospel account gives us the parable of the Good Samaritan? You want to take a guess? Luke, good guess. We've got the parable of the Good Samaritan in Luke chapter 10. It's interesting that it's Luke writing about that. You would hope that it would be in maybe Matthew's account. Matthew's writing to Jews. Did the Jews need to have a better opinion about the Samaritans? Did they need to have a better relationship with the Samaritans? But the gospel account that presents this good Samaritan and taking care of this man who had been beaten is in the Gospel of Luke. And so are, all of these others. Who is it that tells us about the thief on the cross talking to Jesus? It's Luke. Who cares about the thief on the cross, right? I mean, this guy, he did something wrong. He's being crucified. Let him die. Who cares about what's happening? Well, Luke did. And so Luke shares with us a lot of these people that wouldn't be, anybody. And so you read Luke, and here's this spirit of mercy that comes throughout the book. Now again, think about who he's writing to. He's writing to Gentiles. And they need to see a picture of Jesus that presents him as the perfect, ideal man. And so remember, we see these things through the eyes of Luke, but who are we looking at? We're looking at Jesus when we see these things. And it's Luke who's helping to present these things to us in this way that he shows us not only was Luke this kind of a humanitarian, but so was Jesus. Very quickly, this last point about Luke being a loyal companion. We don't know much about Luke. We've got three verses, and we'll look at them in just a minute. Three verses in the New Testament that even have his name. And yet here is this man who all we know about his life is to save souls. He wrote two books in the Bible. One of them is to tell people about Jesus. Do you tell people about Jesus to save their soul? Yeah. The other book he wrote is the book of Acts. It tells people about the church. Tells people how to become a part of the church. Tells them why they need to be in the church. Tells them how the church is going to grow. So everything that this man writes is wrapped up in the Lord and in his church. And we don't have time to look at this history of him traveling with Paul. But his name's not even mentioned in the book of Acts. So how do we know in Acts 16 that he traveled with Paul from Troas to Philippi? It says we. Luke chapter, or Acts 16 verse 9 says that they came to Troas. And it's in verse 10 and 11 where Paul sees the vision. And it says, we immediately sought passage to Philippi, to Macedonia. So it changes the pronouns. And so you can see Luke being involved in the travels of Paul. He stays in Philippi, and it's they who leave in Luke in Acts 16 and verse 40. He's picked up again by Paul in Philippi at the end of his third missionary journey. He's with Paul in prison in Caesarea. He's with Paul while Paul is in prison in Rome the first time. While Paul is in prison in Rome the second time, Luke is with him. We know all of that just because of that little word "we" throughout the book of Acts. But here's what I want us to see in Luke being a loyal companion. Paul's first Roman imprisonment, Colossians 4:14. First time his name is mentioned. It's at the end of this book. He's like in the credits, right? Is that what you think when you read the end of Paul's letters? It's like the credits at the end of his letters. Here, so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. They say hi. And by the way, when you're there, say hi to so-and-so and so. It's like the credits at the end of the movie, right? You know, and that's kind of the part of the letter you might skip. That's the part of the movie you skip, right? Who cares about the credit? Well, here's Luke. He makes the credits. He makes the credits in two of the books. Luke's with me when he writes Colossian letter. Luke's with me when he writes the Philemon letter. And by the way, those are written while they're several books apart in the New Testament. They're written at the same time. Paul's in prison in Rome for the first time. And some even have thought maybe he wrote the book of Colossians and the book of Philemon on the same day. No way to prove that, obviously. Who is the book of Philemon written to? Two of you knew it. 40 of you were scared to guess. Book of Philemon's written to Philemon. Where was Philemon from? Where did he live? What city? Colossae is where he was from. And so he's from the same city that Paul writes the book of Colossians to, so maybe that's why some people believe he wrote it on the same day. But here's Paul in his second time he's in prison. He's writing the book of 2 Timothy, and look down in verse chapter 4 and verse 11 where he says, "Only Luke is with me." And here's why I say he's a loyal companion. Look at Demas. Demas is with him the first time he's in prison. But the second time he's in prison, 5, 6, 7 years later, Paul says in 2 Timothy chapter 4, "Demas has forsaken me." Only Luke, he says, only Luke is still with me. He traveled with Paul to Jerusalem, traveled with Paul from Jerusalem. He did all of that. And here he is in prison. And who else would you want with you in prison but a doctor, right? Especially when they're feeding you the food that you get in prison. Wouldn't you want a doctor there, right? Taking care of you along the way. We had to run through some of that. I hope some of this has been helpful for us to get a picture of a man that maybe we didn't know too much about. We'll take a break for just a few minutes before worship.